Coming up on this week's book show, renowned astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson is the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. His new book, Letters from an Astrophysicist, shares his correspondence with people who have sought his perspective on questions about science, faith, philosophy, and of course, Pluto. Neil deGrasse Tyson on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. For decades, Neil deGrasse Tyson, renowned astrophysicist and host of the radio and television show Star Talk, has spotlighted his insights into the cosmos. He's the author of the number one best-selling book, Astrophysics for People in a Hurry, which remained on the New York Times bestsellers list for more than a year. His new book, Letters from an Astrophysicist, shares his correspondence with people from around the globe who have sought his perspective on questions about science, faith, philosophy, and of course, Pluto. Dr. Tyson is the Frederick P. Rose Director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History in Manhattan, where he has served in that role since 1996. His new book, again, Letters from an Astrophysicist, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Neil deGrasse Tyson to this week's book show. How are you, sir?
Thanks for having me. Wonderful
to have you on the program. I think the last time we spoke was when the last book was just out. Did you have a sense that would hit the way it did, in the sense that people wanted to know about this stuff, that idea of science for people in a hurry would connect?
That's a great question. So my thinking behind that book, which is now came out in May of 2017, yes, first, I was surprised that it did as well as it did. It stayed on the New York Times list for 84 weeks. What intrigued me most was that it was like a cork bobbing on tide waters that came in and out. And the tide waters were books on political subjects. There was pro-Trump books and anti-Trump books and investigator books. The astrophysics book just kind of stayed there, bobbing in and out, which told me that there remains some appetite out there for sort of objectively true books, books that are just I want to learn something today rather than just figure out why I should hate or love one politician or another. So that gave me hope for the world that there remains an untapped or unfed curiosity, and books such as that would feed it. I thought it would do okay, only because I looked at how often books do well when they have words in their title that relieve you of working hard. So, Auto Mechanics for Dummies, there was just one, you look at books with those kinds of titles. Bill Bryson famously had, A Brief History of Everything. Stephen Hawking, A Brief History of Time. The word brief seems to matter in these. I didn't like the word brief, but I knew that from how I wrote the material, that I might be able to serve people who are in a hurry. Some people came to that book saying, I thought it would be Astrophysics for Dummies, but it wasn't. And I said, well, first, that title was already taken. But second, there is no, I don't think any of the material is dumbed down. It's just handpicked for maximum mind-blowing potential for the reader. And in that way, it becomes a very rich discourse on what is fun and interesting about the universe, and it's not very long. If I had to take you to a hard place in a paragraph, I'd make sure the next paragraph was an easy place, Or if you feel like you're slogging through a chapter, and then you look to see how much longer the chapter is, there's only 3 pages left. You can get through that.
You can handle that.
So, right on down to the preface. I hate prefaces in books. Well, if it's that important, put it in the damn book. Why put it in a preface? but sometimes they're necessary. So I wrote the preface. For others out there like me who don't like the preface, if you turn the page, it ends right there. So of course you can finish the preface. So the book is deeply conceived to help you, the busy reader, get through this material. And so it turned out to be more successful than I had imagined for it.
Now, without getting overtly political, which I don't mean to do here, but one of the things that is fascinating as you talk about it bobbing around with those other books is that it came out in a time when some people had just put aside this idea of science. And even that was in question. So for some of us to look and see a book like this do so well for so long, it gave us some faith.
Yeah, I agree. I would say not so much faith, but evidence.
Well, there you go. We'll take
faith
that
is
too.
What you faith is what you have when you don't have evidence. But the fact that the book did well becomes evidence that people still have some kind of thread or still care about threads back to science and what science can do for you.
So you spoke a moment ago about the nature of the last book, For People in a Hurry. The new book is Letters from an Astrophysicist. And in these letters, you are answering very specific questions. And you do it so, again, in a very succinct manner, taking on huge issues and an opinion. You're obviously going off of what the question is, but it gives you an opportunity of directly answering the question, which doesn't take you long to do, really.
Thanks for noticing that fact, but a couple of points I think are worth emphasizing. The content of this book, Letters from an Astrophysicist, it highlights exchanges I've had with people on subjects that I hardly ever otherwise talk about in public. There's 101 letters, and at least a dozen of them are people trying to reconcile their religious faith with what science has showed them to be true in the universe. And there's deep angst in there. One person is pleading and says, Dr. Tyson, is there any way science can give us a 6,000-year-old universe? And he's pulling this from a literal read of biblical Genesis, of course. And so I just go through with him step by step. And he ends his letter by saying, because if there's no God, then I find the universe to be unbearable. So I worked with him to separate those two factors, right? Whether the universe is 6,000 years old does not directly require that you do or do not believe in an all-powerful creator. There's a lot of sort of working with people in whatever is their state of mind at the time. There's a heart-wrenching one, just to throw this in there, from a middle schooler who wants to be an astronaut or aerospace engineer when he grows up. And, oh, by the way, he has seizures. And the kids make fun of him when he has the seizures. And they tell him he'll never be an astronaut or he'll never be a scientist. He'll never be a mathematician. And he wants my help because he wants to make a science fair project as good as it can be. And if I help him do that, then maybe if he does well with the science fair project, that people will stop making fun of him. This is what and then he asked, was I bullied when I was a kid? I mean, these are people coming to me with some of their deepest issues in their lives. It's a huge responsibility to even be at the receiving end of these inquiries, which is why I'm succinct in the sense that I'm very clean in my replies in terms of the efficiency of communication, but I will go wherever the full answer requires to go in order to do justice to the question and the state of mind and intellectual curiosity of the questioner.
Neil deGrasse Tyson is the author of the new book, Letters from an Astrophysicist, which is out from Norton. Although in our current world, given technology, just the fact that people are writing you, whether it be email or a stamped letter, it must be nice to have that correspondence, and even nicer for those receiving a letter back from you that has been thought about and being able to communicate with that individual at that level.
So I had come to learn about a third, maybe as many as a half, but I remember specifically a third of people, when they get a reply, their next reply to me was, oh, I never thought you'd even read my letter, much less reply. So it seems that in that world, the expectations are very low for the engagement in this way. What it told me was, whatever I'm doing out there, people feel warm enough or comfortable enough, that's the word I was looking for, to share with me these challenges they face in life. One of them, there's an older man who was diagnosed with terminal cancer. He has 6 months to live, and he wrote this letter just as sort of a last thank you for all the material I had created that he had dined upon in his retired years to remain a lifelong learner. And so these letters are very moving in this regard. By the way, there's a whole chapter on hate mail. There's some angry people about something I said or something.
I was going to get to that, yes.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I don't know to jump the gun.
No, that's fine. We'll have plenty of time for it.
I just didn't want people to think it was an entire love fest in the book.
Well, no, but you said this a moment ago about people pleading with you, and there is this letter. There are a couple of them, but there's this one just looking for proof and saying, I feel sorry that you don't seem to believe in God and think that everything came into existence by random chance. He goes on to say that he is an engineer, and he says, I can see no way that something as complex as a human being, DNA, the universe with all its robustness, could have made itself from random chance or from a big bang. I ask this as a question in light of what you said a few moments ago, that these are things that you don't often talk about otherwise, which is interesting to me.
Yeah, I just don't. You've never seen me debate creationists or UFO people or conspiracy theorists. I had one brief foray into the flat Earth folks. That's for a whole other reason. Oh, by the way, that foray is included in this book,
right?
Because it was a letter back to a very popular rap artist who started tweeting. I have to tell this story quickly. The rap artist called B.O.B., those initials, yeah. And the O is a lowercase. He started spouting out that Earth is flat in social media. And I started getting people in my social media comment stream saying, Neil, you got to do something about B.O.B., save him from himself. And then I realized these are people who are in whatever is the Venn diagram intersection of my followers plus the followers of this very successful rap artist. And so these are people who see us both and want me to step in and fix things. Well, generally I don't do that, except in this case, he was saying, I use equations from physics and I math and I demonstrate unequivocally that Earth is flat. No, that's fighting words right there. If you're going to say you're invoking physics, then I'm going to have to jump in your situation. So I looked at his formulas and they're flawed, and I showed the correct formulas. And I was called into the Larry Wilmore show, which is not on the air anymore, but it was on Comedy Central. And I gave a formal rebuttal to B.O.B. That's in the book as well. The book, Letters from an Astrophysicist, about 10% of them are just open letters that I've written to just everyone, including a letter reflecting on September 11th, because I was eyewitness four blocks away from the collapse of the towers. And I wrote a letter to friends and family and colleagues 24 hours after that. That's in this book as well. So it's things that, the fact that you don't see me arguing these other sort of pop culture things, Bigfoot, you know, as I said, aliens, all of that's in this book, because I would not shy away from that if someone came to me with that question. I just didn't make public platforms out of them.
Which gives you an idea that everything, or gives me the idea anyway, that everything in some way or another then falls into astrophysics. That you really can't get away from everything.
Yeah, let me say that differently. I agree, but let me sort of put some nuance on it.
I'm sure you can say it better.
That all the questions that people came to me with in my answers are informed, if not intellectually, certainly philosophically and emotionally, they're informed by a cosmic perspective. So that when I reply to people, I'm coming from a very different place than they might have expected or known that I could come from. And in one case, which is my favorite exchange in the entire book, just based on all the places it goes and its meaning, there's a woman, a devout Jewish woman who's sending her 10-year-old kid to Hebrew school. And as generations of Jewish families have done before her, and by the way, her son is on the autism spectrum. And one day he came home and said, I don't believe in God and the Bible's fairy tales, and I don't believe any of it. And she said, well, why do you think this? And he said, from Cosmos. He'd been watching the Cosmos series. Mm. So, okay, so I'm in deep trouble now. Should I keep reading or should I like hold it aside? I kept reading. And she just simply wanted to know whether, and she trusts me, she trusts her son. She doesn't want him to believe something that's not true. So she genuinely asked, can science and religion coexist? Or must they be separate? And what she just wants to be a good parent. And it took me more than a year to reply to this, just because I wanted to think about it. I had to, am I the right person? What should I do? Finally, I replied, and it's in there. And I think it's one of my best replies ever, given all of the sensitivities and the needs and the parenting and the all of this combined, all came together in that one exchange.
When you are dealing with science and you are dealing with, as you indicated earlier, facts, and you are replying to someone, is it difficult to remove, or do you have to read it over a few times to make sure that there isn't condescension implied or direct in a response?
Yeah, there's no chance that there would be direct condescension because that's never my intent. Now, in these days, these modern times, there are sensitivities out there that are greater than they've ever been in the past. And so if one wants to play in that space, to educate in that space, one needs to do some extra homework to find out what is the sensitivity barometer registering today compared with yesterday or last month or last year. So yes, I will reread it, checking for those sensitivities. I don't have a problem conveying objective truths that conflict with someone's belief system. I'm not worried about you being offended by something that is objectively true. I worry that if I say something in a particular way, you could just shut down from reading any further. And that's not effective. My father, before he passed a couple of years ago, noted throughout my life that it's not good enough to be right. You also have to be effective. And I've argued with Richard Dawkins about this. He's, you know, the sort of leading public atheist out there among a few. And he's so witty and so has such command of vocabulary, that British Oxford command of vocabulary that Americans, that none of us have ever achieved or possibly ever will. And he's used that to actually make you feel stupid or dumb or uneducated if you believe in God. And I've told him, and I said, this turns people off. How do you feel about this? And he actually took my criticism to heart, or I don't know if he took it to heart, but he appreciated my criticism, and it may have sensitized him going forward with regard to how you communicate, no matter what it is you think or feel. But I do think about it, yes.
You just mentioned your father. You include, the epilogue of the book is a letter to your father. It was based on a eulogy that you delivered. It's beautiful. And I'm wondering, it would seem to me, if it were me, that would be like the hardest thing you have to write.
It's hard, but it's easy.
Right.
So the hard part is, you know, a eulogy is you're trying to summarize someone's life in front of others who didn't know the person as well as you did. And how do you do that? Do you do it just as a bullet point? Do I speak as his son or as his biographer, right? You have to find the thread that matters. And the thread that I found was just sharing with the public certain aspects of his life that he either purposefully shared with me or were there visible for me to observe that influenced major elements of my life. So I put it in as an epilogue because it's kind of summative of what drives me with the ancestral thread of influence shared with the reader.
You start off the book, I mentioned the epilogue. The prologue is happy 60th birthday, NASA. You point out that both you and NASA are the same age. Where does that leave
down to the week? Down,
down to the
not
week.
Only say, yeah, we're
very
born
specific.
The same week. Yes, thank you.
Where does that, in your mind, where do you think we are with NASA, and what should we make of the future of that very important agency?
What I did with that letter was try to take the audience, you know, how do we get here from there? And that there was the formation of NASA out of the fearful times of the Cold War, in the meat of the Cold War, where Sputnik is flying overhead. So NASA is founded a year after Sputnik flies. So that's not an accident. That's very purposeful. In that letter, it's a very heartfelt letter, because we're the same age, but we had very different lives. There's NASA going to the moon in the 1960s, and I'm dealing with sort of civil rights discrimination, prevented from moving into apartments that my family wanted to move into in 1964, I think that was. People were picketers outside. There was an all-white community, and we were going to move in. And we were prevented initially, but then, you know, laws were passed, and then we moved in. And those apartments called Skyview Apartments, where prophetically, perhaps, because from the roof is where I brought my telescope to drink in the night sky, albeit it was only from the Bronx in New York. NASA's come a long way since then, from the fighter pilots with crew cuts that all look like they were carved out of the same section of granite from the mountainside. And NASA looks much more like the public, the general public, with its proportion of women and other sort of previously underrepresented groups. So now we have to ask, what is next for NASA? And we have to ask that ourselves, right? It's not, oh, NASA, what are you going to do? It's, what do we want NASA to do? NASA is a public space agency. We fund it. So it's up to us. And I've been trying to say, let's send astronauts to Mars, something we've never done before. It would extend a space frontier in terms of what we need to do to make that happen. But the value of that is, first, it's space, which if you're, let's say you're an oceanographer and you want to attract eighth graders into the field, and you say, well, there's the go down to the Marianas Trench off the coast of the Philippines, and it's the deepest part of Earth's crust, and there are life forms there we've never seen before, we think, and you're going to come, who's with me? And everybody says, yeah. And then I walk in, and I say, one of Jupiter's moons, Europa, at Jupiter, it has an ocean that sits beneath a layer of ice, and that ocean's been liquid for a billion years, and there might be alien life there. Who's with me? Well, I just stole all of your students. I can do that every time, almost no matter what science subject you're bringing to them. Oh, you want to be a biologist? We still don't know how you go from organic molecules to self-replicating life, and there's still species to be discovered on Earth, and the ecosystem and the biosphere. And then I walk in and I say, there might be alien life in the soils of Mars. Who's with me? I'm getting everybody. So why not it's not just because I think this is true. This is really true. So why not exploit this truth and say, let's make space the gateway field for people to enter the sciences and engineering and math. And it's a gateway. And if you want to stay on Earth, fine. But we've got you there to begin with. And innovations in science and technology in today's world form the engines of tomorrow's economy. So you'd be doing this to stoke the American economy in the coming decades. And that would be a justifiable reason to do it. To do it to explore, because it's in our DNA, you might feel that. That never had anybody write a check. That's not insufficient to make that happen.
You mentioned the hate mail. There's a letter in here in which they're replying to a tweet that you tweeted on July 4th, 2012, so Independence Day. You write in this tweet, on the day we reserve to tell ourselves America is great, July 4th, Europe reminds us that we suck at science. There is a hashtag Higgs boson. Do we suck at science?
So maybe it's relative. Because we would have discovered the Higgs boson, which is this elusive particle in particle physics whose field grants mass to other particles that pass through its field. There was the big hunt for the Higgs boson, but you need a particle accelerator big enough. So we had one approved under the Reagan administration in the 1980s. By the way, that was still during the Cold War. And by the way, the United States has many other particle accelerators at Brookhaven, Stanford, Oak Ridge, in Chicago, the Fermi Labs. All of these are particle accelerators. Physicists probing the structure of matter at its smallest levels. So what happens? 1989, the wall comes down and peace starts breaking out all over Europe. 1993, the Soviet bloc formally dissolves. And oh, what else happens? They zero the budget for the superconducting super collider. And it's, oh, well, this went over budget or we couldn't do it. No, that's not why. They're not going to tell you this. Neil deGrasse Tyson telling you this now, that if we were still in the Cold War, that would not have, its budget would have not been zeroed. Okay, so what happens? The Center of Mass of Particle Physics goes to Europe, and they build a Large Hadron Collider. And there they discover the super collider, and it was announced on July 3rd of that year. And so I felt compelled to just tell people this. So we suck. No, we don't suck at science, but we're falling behind in science, and that's not the United States I grew up in.
Speaking of the United States that you grew up in, you responded, and this will end our conversation. But so on this note, there at the very early in the book, there was the New York Times put out a Sunday Review section where they asked the question, if I were president, .. And you replied to this. They asked several people, non-politicians, to grapple that question, if I were president. You write, one objective reality is that our government doesn't work, not because we have dysfunctional politicians, but because we have dysfunctional voters. As a scientist and educator, my goal then is not to become president and lead a dysfunctional electorate, but to enlighten the electorate so they might choose the right leaders in the first place. Are you at all optimistic that that can happen?
I don't know. I lay awake at night wondering, we really are living in a simulation, and all this that disrupts the peace and tranquility of the world are just entertainment for the alien kid in the parents' basement. And when things are calm, someone told me, it's when the kid was asked to come up for dinner. So there's a couple of hours where the world is calm. And then they come down and say, oh, that's not interesting. Let's throw in a crazy military invasion or a crazy politician or a crazy this. Well, let's throw in a storm or an asteroid. So I don't know. Sometimes I fear for the future of civilization, not having the confidence that we need to have, that we will be the shepherds of civilization the way we need to be, assuring our survival and the survival of the biosphere going into the future. My hope is that we'll get this internet thing figured out. We're still sort of infants, not knowing what to do with it. Consider that newspapers, a very obvious thing in retrospect that you might print with a printer, took centuries to even be thought of as a thing after the invention of movable type, right? So here we have the internet that's not more than 15, 20 years old, and maybe there's good things to happen that we'll all agree with, and it won't just become the cesspool of division that it has become in recent years. Maybe we're just infants poking at it, wondering how to make the best of it. And if that's the case, then I do have hope for the future.
Letters from an Astrophysicist is Neil deGrasse Tyson's newest book. It is published by Norton. Dr. Tyson, thank you very much for being with us. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.